especially in the summer. Dew on the grass, birds waking up, air smells clean. If we can get Gar moving, we can be in and out of Dallas before it gets light, Buck said. They were walking back across the parking lot when Poole came down the stairs carrying his duffel bag. Let's just go, he said. We can eat on the road. Box insisted on checking the motel room one last time to make sure they weren't leaving anything. Poole and Darling waited impatiently until she got back, she said. We're good. And they were on I-35 by 4:45, traveling fast. 2 hours later, they were at the storage units. Box traded her Audi for the pickup, back down the narrow alley to another storage unit, and Poole and Darling helped her load a favorite table and chairs in the back and covered it all with a blue plastic tarp tied tightly into the truck bed. Poole left his Mustang in another bay and loaded his share of the gold and money into Darling's truck. Darling waited while Poole and Box said goodbye.
I'll see you in New Mexico, he said. Once we're there, we'll be okay.
God damn it, Gar. I wish we didn't have to split up, Buck said, leaning into him. It's safest this way. We should be okay. We've still got to jump on them, but if one of us gets stopped... I know, I know.
They spent a minute kissing goodbye, Buck's arms wrapped around Poole's neck until Darling called.
Sun's coming up.
Poole pushed her away and said, New Mexico. New Mexico, she said, and got in the truck.
Although their separate routes would be roughly parallel, Poole and Darling took the longer run. They planned to go south from Dallas on Highway 281 to Burnett, then west until they picked up I-10 into El Paso. Box would take I-30 through Fort Worth and then I-20 most of the way across West Texas until she also hooked into I-10 to El Paso. El Paso bordered New Mexico to the north and west and Mexico to the south. They all had passports. If worse came to worst, they might be able to hide the money in the States and cross the border to Juarez, Mexico, at least long enough to slip the American law. The sun wasn't quite up when Box left the storage units and had just peeked over the horizon when she got on I-30. From there, it was smooth sailing out on I-30 and then I-20 heading southwest. She'd decided she'd stop for breakfast at Abilene and then push on. The manhunt would be in the Dallas area. The farther away she got, the better off she'd be. Poole called at 8.
We're out of town. How are you doing?
Doing good. I'm on I-20, thinking about breakfast at Abilene.
See you tomorrow.
Tomorrow, babe.
Then everything went to hell, and all at once. She didn't see the highway patrolman until she was right on top of him. She had crossed a bridge where low trees crowded right up to the highway, and there he stood, a radar gun in his hand. His car was parked behind him, off the side of the road. Box tapped the brake, saw that she was no more than 2 or 3 miles an hour over the speed limit. She was in the slow lane, being passed regularly by most of the traffic, and her first thought was, okay. Then she looked in the rearview mirror and saw the highway patrolman running for his car. She was a quarter mile down the highway before he got to it, and another few hundred yards when the light bar came up and the patrol car hit the highway. She had no doubt in her mind he was coming after her, and that was confirmed when he moved into the same lane. She said, shit! And with panic tight around her heart, she floored the gas pedal. There was no way she'd outrun him. Not on the highway, she could see him closing. And a few seconds later saw an exit sign coming up. She took the exit, Highway 919 North, and a sign that said, Gordon. There was no town at the end of the exit ramp, and the cop was getting very close, hitting the end of the exit ramp as she made the turn onto 919, still coming. On 919, she pushed the truck as hard as she could, tried to get the phone up to call Poole, fumbled it, saw it drop into the passenger footwell. No way to get it.
"Oh, my God!" she cried.
The cop was no more than 100 yards behind her and still closing. To her left, a dirt road cut off into the scrubby trees, and she said again aloud, "Fuck it!" and took the turn. By the time she got straight, the cop was right on her bumper, siren wailing into the morning. There'd been no rain for a while, and she started throwing a cloud of dust and could see the cop back a ways, and up ahead an even narrower track. She took that one, deep into the woods, crashed across a dry creek bed, powered away, saw the cop hit the dry bed, get across it, still coming. She had some hope now. First chance, she left the track altogether, weaving through the trees. The truck bottomed once, twice, wheels grinding into the raw dirt, and then the cop was gone. She could still see the multicolored red and blue flashers back through the trees, but she kept going, and when she couldn't see them anymore, stopped long enough to get the phone off the floor and call Poole, and started driving again. When Poole answered, she cried,
"They're all over me! The cops are all over me! I'm running through the trees! What? What?"
"They must know the truck. I wasn't speeding. I was in the slow lane, and the cop saw me, and it came right after me," she said. "I got off the highway into the woods. I'm running through the woods. I've lost them now, but I can't go back on the roads."
"Listen," Poole said. "Now listen. How far away are they?"
"I don't know. I've lost them. I'm lost. I'm off-road. I'm back in all these trees."
"Keep going. See if you can spot a house or anything that you'd recognize later. Anything.
Then get the money and gold out and stick it under a tree or somewhere people can't see it. You gotta hide it. If you hide the money, they got nothing on you, babe. They got nothing." The truck bounded over a hump of dirt and onto another dusty track. She wasn't sure, but she thought she was moving away from the cop car, the sun still at her back. Up ahead, she saw the corner of a metal building, and she said into the phone,
"Okay, I see this building up ahead. Just the corner of the roof, it's silver. Okay, and off to the side I can see the interstate through a hole in the trees. I must have come back to the interstate. I'm going to turn down that way."
She followed a line of dirt, not even quite a track, past the edge of a pond, and rolled up to a fence and said,
"There's a fence. I can't get across it."
Poole, calm. "Can you stop there?" She couldn't see anything in the rearview mirror.
"Maybe. I'll stop."
She stopped the truck, got out. She could still hear the cop's siren, but it must have been several hundred yards away. One of the low, scrubby trees, 10 yards inside the fence line, had branches that dropped all the way to the ground. She popped open the back doors on the truck, got the 2 black cases with the gold and the cash, hauled them over to the tree, and pushed them back through the knee-high weeds to the tree trunk. She stepped back to check. The briefcases were invisible. She walked back to the truck and said,
"I put the gold and the money under a tree in high grass. You can't see it. The branches come right down to the ground. I'm going to the tree."
She went to the tree and paced off the distance to the fence.
"It's 10 long steps from the fence, probably 10 yards, and I'm right across from the entrance to a road on the other side of the interstate. I'm only a little way west from the exit to Gordon, Texas. North side of the interstate, west of the exit. Gordon, Texas. G-O-R-D-O-N. From where I am, I'm looking right past the pond to the silver roof."
"Got it all," Poole said.
"Get yourself out of there," Try staying on the back roads. See if you can find a place to hide until dark.
I don't think that's going to work, babe, Buck said.
If it doesn't, don't say anything to the cops, Poole said. Not a word except, I want a lawyer. You've heard me talk about this. You want a lawyer.
I've still got the gun.
Long silence then.
You've never used one before. I don't think that's a good idea.
I could ditch the truck and walk over to these buildings, see if I might catch somebody there.
I don't think so. You don't have time to clean up the truck, get rid of prints and all that.
You shoot somebody, kidnap somebody, then you're in the shit.
I think you better throw the gun away. Sturgill is saying the same thing.
Okay, I'll do that, Buck said. Listen, do you have that orange blouse with you? The one I bought in Dallas and you don't wear?
Yes, it's in my suitcase.
If you have time, get it out of the suitcase and rip a piece out of it and tie it to the bottom of the fence like 10 yards from the tree where the money is. Make it easier to find when we come back for it.
If we come back. We will, babe, we will, Poole said.
I'm hanging up now.
Oh, God, God.
I'm hanging up.
She found the orange blouse, but instead of ripping it, simply bunched it up and tied it to the bottom of a fence post 15 long steps west of the tree where the money was. She went back to the truck, got the pistol she had kept for self-protection, and threw it under the tree with the money and gold. Then she got back in the truck, called Poole, and said,
"Okay, baby. The orange blouse is on the bottom of the fence 15 long steps west. That's west of the tree where the money is. You have to walk along the fence to see it. The gun's with the money.
Move away from there, then. Take it slow. There's probably a road past those buildings or a driveway. See if you can sneak out of there."
"I'm gone again," she said. "I need both hands to steer. I'm back in this really rough place."
She hung up, dropped the phone on the seat, and worked her way through the rough track to a smoother one, then down the track to the buildings. There was nobody around them, no vehicles, and she followed a driveway out to a dirt road and along the road for a few hundred yards parallel to the interstate. The thought of surrendering to the police frightened her more than she'd ever been frightened in her life. She cut across a hard-surfaced road, hesitated, it felt too exposed, then turned toward the interstate and drove past a restaurant and under the interstate and then south. She might have gotten away, she thought later, if she had only moved faster. Not a lot faster, if she'd just gotten under the interstate 5 minutes sooner. She'd crossed under it and was headed south, and she was thinking about the blue tarp on the back and how she ought to get rid of it because it was instantly identifying when she felt the rhythmic beating on the windows. She didn't know what it was, only that it was close, and a moment later, a helicopter passed overhead, and lo, turning in front of her, the pilot looking straight down at her. The jig, she thought, was up. She kept going, a mile, a little more, then caught sight of the flashing light bar behind her, the helicopter still there in front of her.
"Screwed," she said aloud.
She picked up the phone, did a redial. Poole answered, and she said,
"They got me. I'm throwing the phone. Love you, Gar. Love you, babe."
And he was gone. She accelerated suddenly, and the helicopter turned ahead of her, and she took the moment to throw the phone out the window. Another 200 yards, the cop car closing from behind, and she pulled over, took a deep breath, got out of the truck, put her hands over her head. The cop car stopped 50 yards away. The cop got out of the car, stayed behind his door, pointed a rifle at her. She thought it was a rifle, maybe a shotgun. He shouted,
"Everybody out of the truck!"
"I'm all alone," she said.
The cop ducked back to the car, said something, and then shouted,
"Walk toward me until I tell you to stop."
She did that until he shouted, "Stop!" Another car was coming up from behind her, and she turned and saw another patrol car. The helicopter was higher now, but still overhead, still making noise. The two cops took a while to check out the truck, then patted her down and cuffed her. One of the cops had curly blonde hair and a name tag that said Oaks, and he asked, "Where'd Poole bail out?"
"Who's Poole?"
And then, "I want a lawyer," she said. The other cop had dark hair with the shine of gel and a name tag that said Martinez, and he said, "Listen, honey, if Poole's back there in the trees and he shoots somebody to get a car, then you're going to the death house with him. You can't say, 'I want a lawyer,' and get out of this. You're still an accomplice." She said, "I'm alone. I was always alone. I don't know any Poole. I bought this truck from a guy in Texas, and when the police officers started chasing me, I panicked. I thought the price was too good, and I thought maybe the truck was stolen, so I panicked. I was always by myself." Oak said, "Nice try, Dora." He reached into his back trouser pocket and took out a piece of paper and handed it to her. She remembered the photograph quite well. It had been taken at an office party when she was temporarily working at an auto parts place in Franklin before she went off with Poole. The likeness was excellent, and her facial features had held up well over the 7 or 8 years since the photo was taken.
"I want a lawyer," she said.
"You'll get one," the cop said. They took her keys and locked up the truck and left it where it was. U.S. Marshals wanted to take a look at it, they'd been told. Box was transferred to the back of one of the patrol cars, and then Oaks made a call.
"Looking for Marshal Davenport," he said.
"This is Davenport."
"We got your Dora Box for you," Oaks said. "You gonna pick her up, or you want her delivered?"
"Tell me where you're at," Davenport said, and, "You're the best news I've had in a long time."
"I haven't ever been anybody's best news, not since my second wife went off with a tool pusher," Oak said. "I truly appreciate you telling me that."
Chapter 21 Lucas, Bob, and Ray were eating breakfast at Happy Frank's Barbecue and Flapjacks when the patrolman called Lucas.
"Got her. Got Box," Lucas told Bob and Ray when he was off the phone.
"No sign of Poole. She was all alone. We got to get out there."
"How far?"
"This is a big state," Ray said.
"We need a helicopter?"
Lucas ran out to the Jeep and got his iPad, brought it back to the table, and as he explained how Box had been spotted, he poked in Gordon, Texas, and found that it was a bit more than an hour away by car from Happy Frank's. He called Fort in Washington to tell him about Box, and Fort went away for 5 minutes and came back with the name and a direct phone number for the head of the Dallas region of the Texas Highway Patrol, a Major Lewis Highstreet. Lucas explained the situation to Highstreet, the urgency of catching up with Poole. Highstreet was a slow-talking man with a dry Texas accent, but moved quickly enough.
"You just sit right where you're at and eat those flapjacks, Marshal, and I'll have a patrol car there in a few minutes. He'll run you back to your motel with his siren and then back through Fort Worth out toward Gordon. I'll have the boys in Gordon transport Ms. Box to the city of Weatherford, which is the closest nearby jailhouse, if I am recollecting correctly. You can interview her there. If you get out of that motel right quick, you'll be talking to her in 45 minutes. Then they can transport her to the federal facilities in Fort Worth or Dallas at their leisure."
"Man, that would be great," Lucas said.
"And Marshal Davenport?"
"Yes."
"Say hello to Happy Frank for me. Would you do that?"
Lucas got off the phone and said to Bob and Ray, "I love this fucking state." Lucas, Bob, and Ray had come to Happy Frank's in a single vehicle, Lucas's Jeep, because they hadn't planned to do anything but eat and talk. Lucas didn't like to ride with other investigators when they were working a case because much of the time they wound up having to do different things in which separate cars were necessary. They needed to get back to the hotel to get cars and clothes for the chase, wherever it might take them. "The problem is," Lucas said as they hastily worked their way through the flapjacks and sausage, "Poole is getting further away every goddamn minute. We need to squeeze Dora, and we don't have much time to get it done."
"I've been reading your paper on her," Ray said. "She could be tough."
Bob said, "Yeah, I saw that thing about her cutting some guy's head off."
Ray, "I was thinking about her being a homecoming queen. Takes a mean, hard-eyed bitch to be homecoming queen, in my opinion."
"I haven't explored this area with you," Bob said. "I take it you weren't the queen?"
"Queen's court," she said. "This girl who beat me? If you'd told her that to be homecoming queen she had to kill her mom and grind her up to link sausage, her mom would have been a dead little sizzler the next day."
Lucas looked at the remnants of his sausage and said, "Thanks for that." The highway patrolman arrived as they were waiting for the check. Lucas threw some bills at the table, and they talked with the patrolman for a moment, got a cell phone number, then fell in behind him in the Jeep. They were back at the hotel in 10 minutes, out of it in 5, and headed west for Weatherford, 3 vehicles tagging behind a cop with lights and a siren, pushing aside the mostly incoming traffic until they were on the interstate, and after that, across suburban countryside mixed with small farms and blocks of dark green woodlots at a steady 90 into Weatherford. The Parker County Jail in Weatherford was a low beige building that looked like it might be used for the storage of cardboard boxes or something equally innocuous. The sheriff came out to see them and take them to the interview room where Box was being held. A lot of cops were hanging around. This all felt like something large. Lucas, Bob, and Ray filed into the interview room. They'd taken the cuffs off Box, but she sat behind an interview table looking like an elf, a small, slender woman with an oval face who'd been crying hard enough to mess up her eye makeup, giving her a raccoon-like appearance. Lucas said, "I'm Lucas Davenport. I'm a federal marshal, and these are Bob and..." Box interrupted.
"I want a lawyer."
The college-sounding guy called Annie and said, "The highway patrol has arrested Dora Box."
"Damn it, where are they?"
"They're at Gordon, Texas," the college-sounding guy said.
"Where's that?"
"West out I-20, an hour and a half from where you're at," he said. "Hang on a second, something is happening." He went away for much longer than a second, then came back and said, "They're moving her to the Parker County Jail in Weatherford for Marshal Davenport, who will interview her there. Davenport is on his way. Weatherford is about an hour from where you're at."
"Where did you get this from?"
"Monitoring the cop frequencies. Since Poole and Box started running, there wasn't anybody who was going to find them and move them other than the highway patrol, so I'm listening in," the college-sounding guy said. "Although nobody's calling it the highway patrol. They call it the DPS.
"That's short for dipshits?"
"Could be, but it's actually the Department of Public Safety," the college-sounding guy said.
"Anything about Poole?"
"Nothing that I've heard. I think they only got her," the college-sounding guy said.
"Now what?" Annie asked.
"I don't have anything to do with that. You might want to talk to the boss." They called the boss, got switched around from the original person who answered the phone to the man himself, and after some discussion, the boss asked, "There is very much money involved here. Is there a chance to retrieve the box lady?"
"Don't see how right now. We could go take a look,"
Annie told him. "If you try, we pay you $200,000. If you succeed and get the money back, we pay you another $250,000.
"We will take a look," Annie said.
Annie had the phone on speaker, and Rosie in court had been listening. When the boss went away, Cord asked, "What do you mean, take a look? Are you crazy? Is he talking about shooting cops to get Box?"
"Not necessarily shooting cops," Rosie said.
"Listen, there's only one thing to do," Cort said. "We pretend to take a look and call the boss and tell him there's no way to get at her. Too many cops all over the place. I mean, the boss wouldn't want us shooting cops. Nobody cares about these criminals like Poole or Darling or even Darling's old lady, but they care about other cops. If we shoot cops and they find out it goes back to the boss, then the boss is in big trouble. They'll go down there and kill him."
"You forget one thing," Annie said.
"What?"
"Rosie, there's $450,000 on the table."
$450,000 for shooting it out with the Texas cops?" Cort was incredulous. "You guys must be rich already. What's that money mean if you're dead? You'd be surprised. They pay us okay, but we aren't getting rich. We drive from Galveston to Charleston dropping off the load. We get $20,000 per run, $200,000 a year," Annie said. "Costs us $100,000 just to stay on the road. If we do it for too long, we'll get caught. We want to retire before that happens. $200,000? That's worth thinking about. $450,000 if we get the money back. We won't be able to retire, but we'll be a lot closer to it."
"That would be excellent," Rosie said. "Move to Palm Springs, play some golf, take it easy."
"This is fucking nuts," Cort said. Annie said, "Shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. It won't hurt to look. And if we can find some way to recover Box, that's all," she groped for a word and finally said, "upside."
Once Box spoke the lawyer word, the questioning had to stop. When he was sure there were no cameras or recording equipment running, Lucas tried non-subtle extortion. "I'm not going to ask any more questions until a lawyer talks to you, but I'll tell you, Dora, you're implicated in the murder of 5 people back in Biloxi. You were living with Poole. You knew he was a fugitive. Even if we don't get him, we've got you. We'll take you back to Mississippi and let those people deal with you. And Mississippi can be pretty goddamn primitive when it wants to be, after a mass murder. You aren't walking on this one. Not without some help, and that's help we could give you."
Ox looked at him, hate in her eyes, and Lucas began to believe that she might once have cut somebody's head off. She said, "Lawyer."
Lucas, Bob, Ray, and a highway patrol sergeant met outside the interview room, and Ray asked the sergeant, "You got her purse?"
"We do. We've got both a purse and a travel bag," Ray said. "Let's take a look."
The purse was a small Louis Vuitton leather satchel and contained a wallet with a driver's license in the name of Grace Pelham and another in the name of Sandra Duncan. Neither had an address that went back to the house in Dallas. The travel bag contained 2 bottles of water, some tissue, a box of Tampax, some liquid hand cleanser, and in a small side pocket, a legitimate-looking American passport with a 2-year-old photo of Box and the name Michelle Martin.
"These guys were psycho about security," Bob said, flipping through the passport. There were no visa stamps. "Wonder if they're running for the border."
Lucas asked the patrolman to run the 3 separate names for connections to vehicle license tags. He nodded, said,
"We can do that in a couple of minutes," and, "We haven't touched the truck in case you want it processed.
I'm not sure what we'd be looking for, but I'd like to go through it," Lucas said.
"How far is it from here?"
"Way we fly, another 20 minutes down the highway."
"Let's go take a look at it," Lucas said. "We're not going to get anything from Box right now. Major High Street said you could run her into Fort Worth for us. She might soften up once we've had her inside a federal lockup for a few days."
"We can do that. I'll lead you back to Gordon. I'll have one of the guys move Box into Fort Worth."
They left in a 5-car caravan.
two patrol cars with Lucas, Bob, and Ray bringing up the rear. As they were leaving, the patrol sergeant told them the two driver's licenses were legitimate, that there were no tickets issued to either one, and there were no vehicles associated with either name. The jail was located in a residential neighborhood, and Lucas paid no attention to the RV parked down the street or to the small red car tucked in behind it. RVs and red cars were a dime a dozen. The Ford pickup truck was exactly where Box had left it, on the side of the road. A bored highway patrolman was keeping an eye on it. When they arrived, he came over and introduced himself as Charles Towns, the cop who'd spotted Box's truck.
"I chased her into the trees over on the other side of the interstate. Got hung up on a cut bank, and by the time I got loose, I'd lost her. She might have got away if she'd been a little quicker, but we had a chopper out looking for some boy racers on the Fort Worth Highway. I called him in, and he came right down and spotted her."
"Good work all the way around," Lucas said. "I'll drop a note to Major High Street telling him that."
"Appreciate it."
Ray had a box of vinyl gloves in her gear bag, and they all pulled them on before they started digging through the truck. Bob found one thing of interest in the glove box. There were several insurance certificates made out to Brian Dumble on the truck, dating back 5 or 6 years, and one certificate for a Lynn Marshall on an Audi convertible.
"They put the Audi certificate in the wrong vehicle," Bob said. "It's got the tag number on it."
"This is good. Have Towns check on Brian Dumble for a driver's license and any cars connected to the name or to the Marshall name. Let's get that Audi tag number and the other stuff out to the patrol." The truck had furniture in the back and a suitcase full of women's clothing, but nothing that gave them anything useful. They were finishing the search when Ray said, "The most important thing is, we haven't found a single telephone."
"I was just thinking about that," Lucas said. "There's no way in hell that she didn't have a phone with her."
Towns was standing outside the truck, and he said,
"The helicopter pilot said she rolled down the window a ways back down the road and waved at him like she was giving up. I wonder if she might have been throwing something out instead of waving at him."
"Good thought," Lucas said. "Can you call the guy?"
"Yep, I'll go do that,"
Towns said, and he went back to his car. Lucas, Bob, and Ray had given up on the truck when Towns came back. He said,
"I talked to the pilot. He said it wasn't too long before she pulled over. Probably less than 100 yards.
"We need to look," Lucas said. They had 6 people to walk the roadside ditch. Lucas wanted to start back farther than indicated by the pilot so they wouldn't worry about whether they were cutting it too close. There was a dead tree on the far side of the ditch, halfway to their starting point, and the sergeant said,
"Let me break some branches off that tree. Use them for pokers." "Probably won't find it if we have to poke around for it," Bob said. "I'm not thinking about the phone. I'm thinking about snakes," the sergeant said with a grin.
"Tell you what, I'll supervise the search from up here on the road," Ray said. "I don't do snakes."
The side of the road was a crush of dry yellow grass, some of it with nasty little yellow burrs, a perfect hiding place for snakes, in Lucas's opinion, though, being from Minnesota, he had no idea where a rattlesnake might hide in real life. In movies, they were usually coiled on a rock where they were easy to spot. Here, they'd come out of foot-high grass and nail your ankle. He worked his stick assiduously, and other than a bunch of grasshoppers, disturbed no wildlife. They were 60 yards from Box's truck, snake-free, when the sergeant spotted the phone.
"A burner," Lucas said as he squatted over it. "Cheapest one you can buy."
"Might as well pick it up. We know who had it. We're not losing anything by smudging up her prints," Ray said.
Lucas nodded, picked it up, turned it on. There was only one number in the file of recent calls. He looked up at Bob and Ray and said, "Now we're cooking with gas." Lucas called Fort in Washington, gave him the number for the phone and the number that had been called on it. Fort said he'd track it and get back to them. The truck, Lucas told the patrolman, should be taken to wherever the highway patrol took seized vehicles. "Somebody will get back to you about it, but I don't know who," he said. "There's going to be a blizzard of paperwork starting about tomorrow." "Where are we going?" Bob asked. "Back to Fort Worth. They're running, and if they've gotten a long way down the road, we'll want to be close to an airplane."
"You want to go back in a hurry?"
the sergeant asked. "That'd be terrific," Lucas said. "Ray, should we stop in Weatherford, see if Box has changed her mind?" Lucas asked the sergeant how long it would take to get from the jail to the airport.
"Less than an hour," the sergeant said.
Lucas looked at the others, and Bob said,
"I don't think we'll get anything more from her. Like you said, she might soften up if she's locked up for a couple of days. If you call Fort and tell him we need a chopper or a plane, it could be waiting for us when we get there."
"Let's go to the airport," Lucas told the sergeant. "Lights and sirens." Lucas called Fort and told him what they were doing. Fort said the phone search was underway. Fort called back a half hour later as they circled north of Fort Worth.
"Okay, the target phone is down south of you on Highway 84 near McGregor. You got a road map?"
"I got an iPad," Lucas said. "But I can't look at it right now. Just tell me."
"McGregor is well down south, and it looks to me like they're headed for I-10, which will take them west into New Mexico, Arizona, and California. I-10 runs along the border with Mexico, so it could be they're planning on crossing."
"Box had a good-looking passport in her purse, under a different name," Lucas said.
"Okay, so there's that. Anyway, Box was on I-20, which also intersects with I-10 near El Paso," Fort said. "Maybe they were planning to get together in El Paso. After that, it's a coin toss."
"They don't seem like people who'd be comfortable down in Mexico," Lucas said, "though that's just a guess. Nothing in our paper suggests that either one of them speaks Spanish or has ever been there."
"So what do you want to do?" Fort said. "I have a plane, if you want one. You could be in El Paso 4 hours before Poole gets there."
"Ah, Jesus," Lucas said, and, "All right, let's do it. Tell us where to go."
They flew out of DFW an hour later in an aging Learjet. Lucas knew it was aging because of the worn paint around the door and the worn seats in back.
"How old is this thing?" he asked the co-pilot.
"Don't know exactly," said the co-pilot, who looked like he was 12. "It's a good, reliable aircraft most of the time."
"Wait a minute.
Pilot joke," the co-pilot said. "But I really don't know how old it is."
"Were you born when it was made?"
the co-pilot said. "Better question would be, was my mom born?"
"Just kidding.
But really, I've flown this thing all over Texas, and it's solid.
If it starts to crash, I'm going to shoot you before we hit the ground," Lucas said. "Try to keep that in mind."
"You got guns?"
"Yeah, we got guns."
"That shooting thing, that was a Marshall joke?"
Lucas gave him a hard look.
"Maybe."
Lucas strapped himself into one of the worn seats and cursed himself once again for not going to Mass more often than Easter Sunday. He braced himself for the crash as they lifted off, and when there wasn't one, tried to sleep but failed. He wound up rereading the paper on Poole. Bob did sleep, and Ray took a compact camera out of her gear bag and took some photos of the landscape below and one of Lucas reading the paper.
"You are a picture of diligence," she said.
"I'm a picture of abject fear. If I had my choice between flying to El Paso or getting a colonoscopy, I'd have to think about it."
"Oh, my," she said.
They were on the ground, still alive, in El Paso at 1 o'clock on a hot October afternoon. Lucas had been there once before when one of his men at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Del Capslock, had been shot by elderly gun smugglers. Bad history. Bad omen. He wasn't sure. None of them had looked at their phones while they were in the air. On the ground, Lucas looked at his and found a message from High Street, the highway patrol major, that said only, "Call me immediately." Chapter 22. The women were not getting along. Annie and Rosie were not exactly fashionistas, but they had style. Tight black jeans and high-tech boots, silky-looking blouses. Rosie in pale blue and Annie in coral. They both wore expensive, masculine but feminine aviators. Even the prison tats were keys to a hipness unachievable by the likes of Court. Court, on the other hand, looked like she'd just been wheeled out of a Salvation Army store after cutting her own hair with a jackknife. She could have spent 3 days in a beauty salon, and it wouldn't have changed her face, her body, or the scowl she'd worn since birth, part of the burden she'd carried with her. The sadness and unfairness of her plight was somewhat understood by Rosie and Annie, who had had harsh upbringings of their own. Rosie had been turned out by her stepfather when she was 14. Annie had simply been kicked out by her parents when she was 18, but living with Court's constant complaining, her fundamental evilness, her joy at seeing other people suffer, and her chainsaw voice was becoming a trial. The complaints never stopped. "What happened to the fucking air conditioning? Must be 100 degrees in here. The coffee really sucks. You think you might stop somewhere? I'm getting sick riding sideways. Can't believe you're doing this. You're dragging me into this." They'd driven from Dallas to Weatherford, where Box was supposedly being held in the county jail. They had towed Court's rental car to Weatherford. It made them look even more harmless than the RV did, and they had the towing equipment to do it. At Weatherford, they'd looked at the situation, and then Annie and Rosie had cooked up what Court called a harebrained scheme, and the other two women admitted that it might be. On the other hand, it seemed like it might work. They were watching the jail from the RV, and at that point hadn't seen much except a lot of cops coming and going. Court continued to bitch, and Rosie finally said, "You don't want to be part of it? We'll drop you off at a bus station. We do need your car, and if the boss asks about you, we'll have to tell him that you split." Court thought about walking away. Decided that as crazy as the rescue attempt might be, she'd rather not have the boss on her neck, especially not if he had another Court stashed away. Still, it was worth arguing about, and Court was still doing that when they saw Davenport leave the jail, trailed by two other plainclothes cops. "Those are the marshals from the parking lot where Soto got shot," Court blurted. "You mean where you shot Soto?" Annie asked. Court didn't say anything, and they watched the marshals and some highway patrolmen roll out of the parking lot in a convoy. "Didn't have Box," Rosie said. She turned and looked at Annie. "Maybe you guys should unhook the car and stow the hitch." "I can't believe this," Court moaned. She and Annie unhooked the rental car and stuck the hitch equipment back in the RV's cargo hold. When the car was free, Court got behind the wheel while Rosie rode shotgun. Not literally shotgun. Literally, fully automatic M16 with 230-round mags, purchased new from the Mexican Army and extensively tested in the swamps east of Houston. When they were set, Rosie drove away and began rolling the RV slowly around the suburban roads on the east side of Weatherford, never straying too far from the cluster of roads that led from the jail to I-20. Lucas, Bob, and Ray had just gotten up in the air when the college-sounding guy called Rosie and said, "They're checking her out. They're moving her." The college-sounding guy was now an uninvited guest in the Parker County computer system, which, he said, was wide open. They made it easy to get into, because they got so many dumbasses who need to get into it. Their security stuff dates to about, the moon landing. Rosie called Annie, and Annie said to Court, "You fucked this up. Honest to God, I'll shoot you in the back of the head. I got 2 felonies on my card, and if I get busted for this, I'm going away forever, so it won't make any difference if you're the 3rd one." Court began to tear up. "You're so fucking crazy. You're both so fucking crazy. Shut up and drive when I tell you." Court and Soto had had a good photo of Dora Box, so when Box was brought out of the jail, cuffed and stuck in the back of a patrol car, they both recognized her. "Okay, here's the problem," Annie said, looking at the highway patrol car. "That's a Dodge Charger, a totally hot vehicle. If he cranks it up, you're gonna have to jump all over the gas pedal. I don't think he'll do that, but he could." "You fucking bitch, you fucking bitch." Annie popped the passenger door, went around and got in the back seat, got comfortable, took the M16 off the floor, and touched the back of Court's head just behind her right ear. "Get ready." The patrol car rolled out of the parking lot, and Court, staying well back, followed. They didn't have the local knowledge to tell them how the highway patrolman would get to Fort Worth, but had guessed it would be one of the 3 alternatives. Straight south to I-20, diagonally east to I-20 on East Bankhead Highway, or diagonally east on Fort Worth Highway. They'd studied all 3, working out possibilities, and guessed he'd most likely take Bankhead with the Fort Worth Highway as the 2nd choice. The south route probably the 3rd choice. They were hoping for Bankhead, and when the patrol car made the right turn onto it, Annie in the back seat said, "Yes," and called Rosie and said, "Bankhead, be ready." Rosie said, "Moving now." Rosie was on Allen Street, where she could get easily to either of the 2 most likely highways. When she got the call from Annie, she pulled the RV onto Bankhead, a block ahead of the highway patrol car, and accelerated away 6 miles over the speed limit, headed for a street called Lake Forest Drive. Lake Forest had a big clump of trees north of Bankhead. Annie saw the RV pull out ahead of them and ahead of the patrol car. They were a couple of 100 yards back, with 1 car between them and the cop. She said, "All right, pass now." Court had stopped complaining. She was hanging on the steering wheel with both hands, arms tense as ski lift cables. She pulled up close to the car ahead of them, then swung out across the double yellow no-passing stripes and back in behind the cop car. "Faster now," Annie urged from the back. Court heard her drop the window. "Faster now, faster, faster, faster!" Court was coming up fast, could sense the cop watching them in his rearview mirror. She couldn't see his eyes, but his head was turned toward it. "Take him!" Annie shouted. She'd pulled the blue cowboy bandana up around her face under her sunglasses. She was wearing a long-billed fishing hat to cover her hair. "Take him, goddammit, take him!" And she touched the back of Court's neck with the barrel of the gun. Court accelerated again, hard, pulling alongside the cop car. The cop was looking at them now, frowning, his face only 6 feet away, and Annie swung the machine gun out the window and blew his front tire, and as the cop car screeched off the road, she shot out the rear tire and simultaneously screamed, "Stop! Stop! Stop!" Court jammed on the brakes, and Annie banged against the front seat and swore, and then she popped the car door, and she was out and running to the cop car, which had swung in an uncontrolled circle off the highway, and she was on it, the machine gun pointing through the driver's side window at the cop, who was trapped in his seat, and she was screaming, "Let her out or I'll kill you! Let her out or I'll kill you!" The cop's face was ashen with fear, looking down the barrel of the M16, 2 feet from his head. Annie heard the lock pop on the back door, and she yanked the handle, and she moved the gun toward Box and shouted, "Out! Out and get in the red car! Out and get in the red car! Get out or I'll kill you right here!" On the highway, a brown Porsche SUV had slowed, the driver watching the scene at the cop car. Box got out of the back seat of the cop car, hands still cuffed behind her, and jogged toward the red car. The Porsche had now stopped in the road, and Annie lifted the rifle and blew out its front tires, then fired another quick burst at the back fender of the cop car, rattling through the metal like a steel drum. Box was in the back seat of the red car, and Annie piled in behind her and Court took off. She drove hard for 2 minutes, pulling fast away from the cars now piled up behind the Porsche.
"Faster!" Annie shouted. "Faster, goddammit, or I'll kill you!"
Court had the gas pedal welded to the floor, then braked hard at Lake Forest Drive, took a left, accelerated past the trees, then off the road and into them. As she did it, Rosie was coming down the street in the RV. The three women in the red car, led by Court, with Annie running hard, half-dragging Box, piled into the RV that was already rolling back to the corner. Rosie took a right, back toward the place where the highway patrolman was now standing outside his car, talking into a radio. A half-dozen cars, including the Porsche, were now off the road beside the cop car. Annie was kneeling next to the driver's seat and said, "Don't speed, but gotta hurry before they shut off traffic. Gotta hurry." They went past the cluster of cars as two cop cars, light bars flashing into the afternoon, screeched around the corner off Fort Worth Highway. Rosie turned on Allen, drove out on the Fort Worth Highway, turned left. They passed the jail and then Main Street, going straight west out of town. Court and Box were lying on the RV's floor, and now Box asked,
"Who are you? Who are you?"
Though she was afraid she knew. Court said,
"We want our money back."
Box said,
"Oh, fuck no."
A half hour later, as they pulled into the Walmart Supercenter in Mineral Wells, the college-sounding guy called to say, "The cops don't have any idea of what you might be driving, and don't tell me. You've stirred up a hornet's nest, and I'd get as far away from there as you can, as quick as you can." Annie, Rosie, and Court gathered around Box, and Annie said, "You're gonna have to tell us where the money is, 'cause if you don't, this lady," she tipped her head at Court, "is going to go to work on you with some, you know..."
"Home improvement tools," Court said with a gleam in her eye. "You know, hammers, saws, drills, box cutters, that sort of thing."
Rosie said to Annie, "We might need some plastic sheets."
"We're at a Walmart. What better place to get them?"
Box, still cuffed, said,
"I'll tell you where your money is if you take the cuffs off. I'm not going to try to run. You're all meaner than I am. My arms and shoulders are killing me."
Rosie and Annie looked at each other, and then Annie said, "If you try to run, we'll kill you. We're not fooling about this, Dora."
"I believe you," Dora said.
"I'm okay with taking them off," Annie said to Rosie. To Box, "We've got some handcuff keys. I don't know why."
"Sure you do," Rosie said. "Because of April."
"Let's not talk about April," Annie said. "If I never see that chick again, it'll be way too soon."
"I don't know what you're talking about, but it sounds sort of hot," Box said.
Rosie and Annie looked at her, and Annie said,
"Interesting."
When the cuffs were off, and when Court had stopped complaining about how that made everything harder, and working on Box with her tools would get some straight answers, Box rubbed her wrists and said,
"It's this way. My boyfriend and I..."
"Garpool," Court said.
"Yeah, Gar. We split up, and we're looking for a new place to hide after Dallas came apart. Gar's got the money. We're supposed to meet in New Mexico tomorrow or the next day. He thinks the cops have me now, but I have a phone number for him. We can call, you can listen in. He'll trade the money for me."
"You sure of that?" Annie asked.
"I'm sure."
Annie took out a cell phone, but Box shook her head.
"Not that phone."
She pointed her finger in the general direction of Walmart.
"They got all the cheap phones we need right in there. We make one call, we throw it away."
Court, for once, was on her side.
"That's right," she said. "Everybody tracks phones."
"I knew that," Annie said.
"Let's go get some phones."
Chapter 23 Lucas, astonished, got off the phone and turned to Bob and Ray and said,
"Well, the dope gang showed up."
Bob:
"Where?"
"The cop who was taking Box to Fort Worth. They shot up his car, grabbed Box, and took off. Nobody has any idea where they are." Ray opened her mouth, but nothing came out for a minute. Then she sputtered,
"You gotta be... How?"
Pulled up beside the guy on the highway, blew his tires out with an automatic weapon, stuck the gun in his face, grabbed Box, and took off. Two women did it. One of them was probably this Court. Don't know the other woman. They were both wearing masks. Nobody got hurt, but the highway patrol's deeply pissed. "There's one glass ceiling that's gone. Now we got dope cartel gun women," Bob said. Ray said,
"She's dead.
Dora is." Lucas ran both hands through his hair and said,
"Losing my shit here.
Nothing we can do about it right now. Let's move."
"Where?"
"Wherever he is. Pool. Gotta get the posse going," Lucas said. They talked to Fort, who already had the posse moving.
"We've had a complication," Fort said. "That burner that Pool's carrying is T-Mobile, and their coverage isn't so good in southwest Texas. He shows up, then he drops out. Still looks like he's heading toward I-10. He ought to be there soon, but right now we can't see him."
"Can't sit on our ass, Russ. God damn it, we need to get on top of him. Help us out here."
"We're talking to the Texas Highway Patrol people about a roadblock on I-10, and they're willing to do it. Once he gets past a certain point, he won't be able to get off. The guy who's organizing things for the patrol is Captain Tom Johnson. He wants to meet you at a Shell station out on the interstate."
They rented two GMC Terrains, Bob and Ray in one, Lucas in the other. Once on the interstate, heading east and south, they passed a sprawling industrial complex on the south side of the highway with distant hills that Lucas thought must have been in Mexico. A half an hour after they left the airport, Lucas led the other two off the highway at the Fabens exit and found Johnson inside, chatting with a cashier. Johnson was a tall man with a wind and sunburned face and a brushy blonde mustache. They took a table in the back, and Johnson asked,
"You heard about the problem in Weatherford?"
"We heard," Ray said. "I wouldn't exactly call it a problem. I'd call it a disaster. Anything new?"
If Johnson was offended, he didn't let on.
"They found the car back in some woods, a red Camry. They must have had another vehicle hit out to pick them up."
"Of course they did," Lucas said. "It's Court. Probably the same gun she used to shoot up Soto."
Johnson didn't know about that, so they told him about the murder at the townhouses.
"Sounds like cartel business," he said. "They're getting bolder all the time. A few years ago, they would have written the money off. Not now.
Now they come and get it.
Lucas outlined Poole's probable route across Texas, and Johnson said, We knew that much. What we thought was we'd set up a checkpoint at the intersection of I-10 and I-20, which is down the road away. Once they get that far, they're locked into the highway. We see anybody turning around, we'll run them down. I've got 8 cars available, 2 men in each one, all of them with rifles.
When are you setting up? Lucas asked.
Soon as you say go.
Go, and we're going with you.
After we get a couple of burritos, Ray said. I haven't had anything to eat since that half a flapjack.
They ate burritos, and Lucas bought a cooler, ice, and a 6-pack each of Diet Coke and water, and some power bars, and they followed Johnson southeast across desert, and then up into low, yellow desert mountains, including one that looked like God hadn't actually so much made a mountain as he had emptied out a giant sack of God-sized gravel. And then they crossed more desert toward the intersection of I-10 and I-20. Johnson settled into an easy 100 miles an hour, but the run out to the intersection took almost an hour and a half. They passed a few buildings on the way and an occasional gas station, but only one substantial town at Van Horn, but that was it. I-10 and I-20 came together in a wide looping knot, and the patrol had already blocked off I-10's access farther west toward El Paso and also the I-10 ramp to I-20. Johnson led them to the easternmost checkpoint where traffic, mostly 18-wheelers, was backed up a quarter mile. Lucas got out in the dirt, thought the temperature must be close to 85 or 90 degrees. He was still wearing a sport jacket, dress shirt, slacks, and loafers. As he stripped off the jacket, Bob came up and said, At least it's a dry heat. Fort called.
He's on I-10 now. We got another thing going. There was a call into his phone, and he took it. The call came through a tower in Mineral Wells, which is west of Weatherford.
That's Box trying to negotiate if the cartel's got her, Lucas said.
That's what we think here. The phone's still there, and we've got a half dozen patrol guys and some rangers closing in.
Bet it's a burner.
No bet. But Jesus, Lucas, this is the most fun I've had in years. I'm talking to people everywhere. This is something else. I've got 4 or 5 guys here with me watching the action. We got a guy putting pushpins in a map, for Christ's sakes. You need anything we can do, call.
Yeah, well, I'm standing in the desert in a pair of cleverly calfskin loafers that are slowly melting into the sand, so, you know, cherish the air conditioning.
Ah, stop bitching. It's gonna be a great story, Fort said. We've been looking for Poole since Bush 43. This is gonna be good. If you get him, of course. If you don't, you know, I never heard of you.
Glad to know that somebody's got my back, Lucas said. Fort called again 20 minutes later.
We spotted him again, but only briefly. He was in Fort Stockton. Now he's gone again, but he shouldn't be, unless he trashed the phone.
Lucas got his iPad and walked over to Bob and Ray's truck and got in the back, in the air conditioning. They lost him again in Fort Stockton, but T-Mobile's supposed to have coverage along most of I-10, even if it doesn't on the back highways into Fort Stockton. Fort thinks he might have trashed the phone.
Why would he do that? Ray asked. If he's negotiating for Box, he's got to have a phone that they can call.
Lucas called up a map of Texas. The Verizon data came through grudgingly, but eventually he was looking at the road network between Fort Stockton and El Paso. There wasn't much of one. Lucas turned in his seat and said, What if he's turned south? What if he's going down this way? He drew his finger across the Google map. And plans to cross into Mexico.
Here. I think that's a border crossing. It looks like the road goes across.
He spread the map and called up a satellite view. Presidio. Never heard of it, but it's a crossing, he said, looking down at the satellite view. He traced a route, the only route, that would get Poole from Fort Stockton to Presidio. He touched the map again. Whatever he does, He's got to go through this place. Ray knelt on the front seat to look.
Marfa, I've heard of that. It's some kind of art town, I think.
That can't be right, Lucas said. It's pretty much nowhere. Who'd go there to look at art? What kind of art?
I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Too bad we don't have an easily accessed, widely distributed source of information so we could look it up, Bob said.
Lucas looked down at the iPad in his hands and said, "Fuck you," and brought up the wiki for Marfa, Texas. "Says it's a major center for minimalist art," Lucas said. He looked at the landscape and the satellite photo of Marfa.
"At least that seems right. They got minimalist."
"Make a call," Bob said.
"I don't want to miss this," Lucas said, looking out at the traffic jam. "We're gonna miss it," Ray said. "We're sitting here on our asses. All those cute highway patrolmen are gonna make the bust when it happens. What we'll actually do is shake their hands and say, 'Good job.'"
"Screw that," said Lucas. "If we leave right now, and if that asshole is headed to Marfa, we'll beat him."
"Gotta drive fast," Ray said.
"We can do that," Lucas said. "Give me a couple of minutes." He hopped out of the truck, walked over to Johnson, who was drinking one of Lucas's Diet Cokes and sweating mightily, and asked,
"You got this?"
"If he shows, we got it," Johnson said.
"His phone's off the grid. I'm worried that he's turned south, heading for this Presidio place down on the border."
"Think he's got a passport?"
Johnson asked. He rolled the cool Coke bottle across his forehead. "His girlfriend did," Lucas said. "A good one under a fake name. I'm thinking that me and Bob and Ray should head down to this town Marfa, take a look at cars coming through. If we go right now, we should beat him down there. Not by much, but by some."
"I'll send a car with you," Johnson said. "Give you an extra gun and some extra speed going down. I'll call around, see if I can shake loose some Border Patrol guys to help out at Marfa. If they've been planning to cross into Mexico, they might have been looking at Presidio the whole time. There are lots of people looking at faces in El Paso, on both sides of the border, and Juarez has got a bad rep if that would work into their thinking."
"Then we're going," Lucas said. "Get him, though. If he comes through here, get him."
"We surely will," Johnson said, "and you take care of your own self."
The highway patrolman who went with them was Dallas Gutierrez, a big rangy guy who seemed happy to be moving.
"There's some interesting road between here and Marfa," he told them. "I mean, the road surface is good, but there are some curves where you can get thrown. Don't push me too hard, and I'll get you down there without breaking your necks."
"Lead on," Bob said.
Ray rode with Lucas, offered to drive in case he needed to talk on the phone or look at his iPad. He took her up on it, and she tucked in behind Gutierrez, and Bob came up behind them. The countryside was as barren as anything Lucas had ever experienced. Hard desert outside the car windows, with low mountains that looked like they'd been worked over with God's own blowtorch, shimmering in the heat. About a billion squashed rabbit corpses littered the shoulders of the road. Tumbleweeds were jammed into ranch fences. Despite the heat and rock, the only comparable landscape Lucas had crossed, in terms of bleakness, was on a winter run to Canada through the lowlands of northern Minnesota, which looked like a black-and-white photograph. Gutierrez told them that the trip normally would take a little more than an hour and a half from where they were, but he expected to make it quicker than that. They did, but it was still an hour and 15 minutes before they rolled into the northern outskirts of Marfa. Halfway to Marfa, Ray said,
"Big country out here. When was the last time we saw a house?"
"I can't remember what a house looks like," Lucas said. "And
what do you have in your gear bag? More than 2 rifles?
"Nope. Guns for Bob and me.
2 rifles, extra mags and ammo, boots, helmets, and vests. We threw in that extra vest for you, but no extra weapons.
Boots won't help much out here. They're heavy and waterproof.
If we find Pool, we gotta think he'll try to shoot his way through. He knows what's waiting for him if we take him.
I got that. I'm working up a buzz,
Johnson called.
There's a border patrol station on the south side of Marfa, off the highway going down toward Presidio. The patrol guys are waiting to set up a checkpoint if you want them to do that.
I'll look it over when we get there, Lucas said. Thanks for that. Marfa itself was a flat town, the high point probably the tip of a radio tower. Lucas had been in any number of flat towns on the northern plains, and Marfa would fit right in there. More pickups than sedans, a venerable county courthouse with a diminutive dome, a brick, concrete, and pole-building main street, no buildings higher than 3 or 4 stories. White houses made of concrete block with stucco and wood and plaster, and vacant lots overgrown with weeds. The horizon was low all around, with distant low mountains like camel humps. Big sky, big sun. Unlike most flat high plains towns, Marfa was also a major art destination, according to Wiki. An artist named Donald Judd had bought an old army fort and set it up as a museum. Lucas had never heard of him. But then he'd never paid too much attention to painting or sculpture, though his wife was a patron of the Minneapolis Institute of Art and gave them enough money that she and the director were on a first-name basis. They rolled through town from the north side to the south, past a water tower, and then past a snazzy-looking hotel and out to the edge of town where Gutierrez led them off the highway to a border patrol station. They got out of their cars, and a border patrolman behind a tall chain-link fence called out to Gutierrez,
"Excuse me, sir, are you an American citizen?"
And Gutierrez asked,
"Have you been drinking, sir?"
And the border patrolman said,
"How you doing, Dallas? You leading this shootout?"
"That would be the marshals here,"
Gutierrez said, nodding at Lucas, Bob, and Ray. He introduced them to the border patrolman, who asked Ray,
"Exactly how dangerous is this guy? He's killed 8 people we're fairly sure about, including a little girl and a highway patrolman. Who knows how many more?"
"Whoa. Shoot first and ask questions later, huh?"
"You mean us or him?" Bob asked.
"Us, of course," the border patrolman said. "Come inside. Our revered leader is gonna PowerPoint you or something."
The revered leader was a tall, white-haired man named Travis O'Brien, who had Colonel's Eagles on his uniform, though nobody called him Colonel. He shook all their hands and sat them down in his office and said,
"This is an unusual situation. I'm not exactly sure where the Border Patrol gets involved in this, but I talked to people at our headquarters, and they talked to some guy at your headquarters, a guy named Fort, and the word came down that we should help any way we can."
"There is a border patrol element in this," Bob said. "This guy is going to try to cross the border with what will look like a good passport, but with an alias. He's set up a bunch of fake IDs with backup documents."
Lucas, Bob, and Ray took turns filling in O'Brien, who finally asked, "When do you expect him to come through?"
"Probably in the next couple hours. If he's coming, he's well on his way."
"All right. Well, we'll get going then. I've already talked to my folks, and we're gonna set up right down the road here on a curve where the highway leaves town," O'Brien said. "He won't see us until he's right on top of us."
"Good enough," Lucas said. "We want to be on the line here, so let's get set up." The Border Patrol knew all about highway checkpoints